The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Do you want a beautiful lawn? Enter True Green, the easiest way to get a great lawn. Just water and mow and they'll do the rest. Weed control, fertilization, aeration, and more. True Green is the official lawn care treatment provider of the PGA Tour, and they have a verified best price, which guarantees you the lowest price with no compromise on quality. You do you. Let True Green do your lawn care. Visit TrueGreen.com, TrueGreen.com to get the best lawn at the best price with the best people. Guaranteed.
Talk is Jericho, baby. Talk is Jericho. Talk is Jericho, mama. Talk is me.
All right, welcome to Talk is Jericho. It's the Pot of Thunder and Rock and Roll, and here we go with the Duff McKagan joke of the week.
Mitch Jericho, how you doing, man? Don't you find it always strange that I just leave you a voice note? Yeah. That ever strike you as odd? Anyhow, has nothing to do with this phone call. I just got back from the doctor, and I always thought those orthopedic shoes were a bunch of hooey, you know? But he suggested I try them, and now I stand corrected. Thank you very much. Goodbye.
All right. I like that one. It makes me laugh just thinking about Duff McKagan wearing orthopedic shoes in the middle of a pandemic. Thanks to Duff for delivering every single Friday without fail. And thanks to everyone who's been hanging out with me on Saturday nights. The Saturday Night Special has been going strong since the lockdown started. And even though some things are starting to reopen and reclosing in some cases, it seems like it's going to be a while before we can go out and see shows and party with our friends in the bars, etc. So come hang out with me tomorrow night. It's a special time. It's going to be 10 p.m. Eastern. And on Facebook Live and my YouTube channel, 10 p.m. Usually I do it at 9 p.m., 10 p.m. On Saturday night. Bring your questions. We're going to continue the Q&A. That's A spelled E-H. Sing-along requests. Bring your beverages and come have some fun. We had some connection issues last week because I was at a undisclosed location in the middle of a thunderstorm, but I'm back at home with my fine scenery behind me. That'll be tomorrow night at 10 p.m. special time on Facebook Live on my official YouTube channel. We'll see you then. All right, today is part two of Ref Week, and I've got my longtime friend and longtime WWE referee, Mike Chioda, is with us. He spent 35 years with WWE before his release just a few months ago. He'll tell you all about the circumstances surrounding his release and sharing a lot of stories about the talent he worked with over 35 years, the huge matches he called, the ribbing he took on road trips, some of the stuff he learned in his early days working for Gorilla Monsoon, talking about Brock Lesnar Big Show match when the ring collapsed, the six-man tag he wrestled in with me and The Rock against the Dudleys and Nick Patrick. Totally forgot about that one. He's got some great memories of China and some of the stuff that would happen in the locker room between the boys. And Mike's even got his first ever t-shirt available at ProWrestlingTees.com. Lots going on with Mike Chioda, and you hear it all starting now on Talk is Jericho. So one thing that's very rare in professional wrestling is longevity. If you can get a gig with a company for 3 years, 4 years, 5 years, you're doing well. But when you've been in a company for 31 years, that's got to be some kind of record, I'd have to say, or one of the longest tenures in history. And that's the tenure of Mike Chioda in World Wrestling Entertainment, World Wrestling Federation. And Mike, is there anybody that was there longer than you that you know of?
Yeah, I mean, not as far as refereeing. I've been in the business, Chris, 35 years with the company.
Wow.
But 31 years when I debuted refereeing. Back in the day, you just didn't come on, you know, and just be a referee. You had to pay dues.
Right.
Ring crew dues. And, you know, like I did ring crew and travel the trucks for 20 years and refereed and stuff. And Chief J. Strom made me a referee way back in the day in the mid-80s.
So you're talking 35 years with the WWE. That's insane.
And yeah, I actually worked for Gorilla Monsoon when I was 15 and 16, setting up the rings with Joey Morella and Victor Quiñones used to, you know, definitely run the ring crew back in them days for Gorilla, because Gorilla owned a certain territory in South Jersey, Philadelphia, Spectrum, and Wildwood, New Jersey, and everything. And I used to do the ring crew on the summer times and on the weekends when I had off, you know, from school.
So when you're talking about that long, I mean, is Tony Chimmel been there that long?
Tony Chimmel's been 38 years. Yes, he was at 38 years. And then he was ring crew and ring announcer. And then I became, I was doing ring crew, and then I became the referee. We were kind of the complete set as a ring crew coming from the Northeast in New Jersey, where it was just, you had a ring announcer, referee, and both guys drove the trucks and set up the rings for many years. Longevity, Chris, is a great statement to make, because that's what, when I grew up in Gorilla Monsoon and Joey Morella and his family out of Willingboro, New Jersey, Gorilla, like, I wanted to be a wrestler when, you know, I was like, I came back into wrestling and asked Gorilla and Joey for a job after my father took a stroke when I was 17. Mm-hmm. So I knew wrestling always brought me great money working on the weekends. Bought me four cars by the time I was 17. And I mean, in a bunch of stuff. I had the best waterbed in the 1980s, I think, back in the day. I made a lot of money on the road. $500 a night on the road when you're 15, 16. You know, that was great money.
It's huge. Sure.
I asked Gorilla back for a job. You know, I wanted to be a wrestler. And he turned around and he seen me taking snap bumps and everything, snap suplexes and all this other stuff in the ring with the boys when we'd set up the ring, and a lot of the guys would get there early. And he goes, hey, look, the longevity in this business is refereeing. And that's what I've told Joey, and that's what I'm going to tell you. So if you want to learn how to bump as a referee, I get it. But stop trying to be one of the boys, because you're not.
Hmm.
And I took that advice, Chris, and that was very good advice. And that's why I think I've lasted this long, you know, because I took in some great advice from some old school talent.
Well, let's just talk briefly about the events of the last month or so, when there was kind of the release. It happens every year after WrestleMania, obviously even worse now with the pandemic. Was this something that kind of took you by surprise, or did you kind of see it coming?
Yeah, Chris, it took me by a complete surprise. I had surgery in October 1st in Alabama, and I had torn rotator cuff and torn bicep. So I went through surgery in Alabama, Dr. Dugas, and surgery went great. I'm healed up great, and I was ready for WrestleMania. Actually signed a new contract in the middle of March. My contract was up. Actually got a little bump in pay. And then I get a phone call on tax day, April 15th. So, yeah, it took me by complete surprise.
Was there a reason given for a guy of your longevity, like we said?
No, there was no reason. I asked if it came from certain people like Vince and Stephanie, and he said no. Mm-hmm. It didn't. It's not like they pulled me out of a hat and said, okay, we have to cut the company, and Mike Chioda's salary is the start of the thing. You know, it was, I think, something completely different. I don't know if it's heat but how can you have heat if you've been off for 6 months rehabbing? And, you know, I haven't even been on Twitter and Facebook since 2015. So it took me by complete surprise, Chris, you know.
It's interesting because you see that kind of happening with kind of the first thing that pops into my head is Mark Yeaton.
Yes.
When they did the same thing to him, he's another guy that had been there for years, and just out of nowhere, he's gone. Like you said, you're going to cut costs, but this is going to start with Mike Chioda and Mark Eaton's contract. That's going to make a difference, you know?
That's correct. I mean, that's, you know, I asked him, you know, like I actually said, you know, I kind of figured he put me on a chopping block ahead of TR. So and he got it passed somehow. So, yeah, I don't know where the heat came from. I mean, I haven't been on the road in 6 months. And, you know, my career is definitely not over. I definitely got plenty left. Whether it's inside the ring or outside the ring, and training referees and work with talent and so forth.
Well, the thing is, too, like you mentioned, one thing you can't teach is experience. You either have it or you don't. And for you, I mean, I'm coming up on my 30th year, and you are even eclipsed that. But let's talk about, you mentioned, you know, how you started with Gorilla and you know, kind of did the ring trucks and all that sort of thing. Let's talk about how the business was back, you know, 35 years ago, Carry the Three. That's 1985.
Right.
I mean, that's almost pre-WrestleMania. It's just as the expansion started. Tell us, what was the company like back then, and how did things work as far as what your job was?
I got put on a trial period. You know, like working for Gorilla Monsoon, even before I started full-time with the company, I would get $50 for the ring, $50 for taking robes, $50 for playing music, and then $50 for timekeeping. Tony Chimo ring announce. And then before the show, I remember Joey Morella and them guys, and like back in the day, Dick Worley and Joey Morella and certain Dick Kroll and guys, you know, of course they didn't sell, you know, the young guy had to sell the programs. So when Victor said, hey, go sell programs, I was like, how much are programs? They're only $1 a piece, right? He goes, yeah. And I said, how much do I get? He goes, 10 cents off the dollar. I said, oh, man. I said, that's it? Well, when I went out and sold 3,000 programs, you know, with Andre the Giant on the cover at the Boardwalk or down at Jersey Shore or Wildwood, I made $300 selling programs and $200 Arnie Skull and go, hey, kid, what'd you do? He'd have the cigar in his mouth and everything in the back and with that briefcase full of money. Okay, I did this, and that, Arnie. He goes, okay, kid, here you go, 500, you know? And I'm like, man, I'll sell programs all the time. I was like, you know?
I just love the lack of corporate back in those days where you guys were the entire show, ring crew, driving the trucks, setting up the ring, selling concessions, whatever needed to be done, that was your job.
You know, I remember back in the day, like when I was that young and Andre the Giant sitting back in Wildwood, New Jersey, and some town, like I remember him saying, hey, kid, get me vodka, get me some wine. And I'm like, Andre, I was like, I'm not even old enough. You know, like, I don't know how to, you know, I can't get it for you. And I remember like it was Paul Roma and a bunch of guys and Steve Lombardi, I think, and a bunch of, you can't say no to Andre. And I'm like, what? And it was like, we're Tony Garea and everything. They were tag team, I think, back then. And Tony Garea and Rick Martel. And they said, you can't say no to Andre. I said, well, how am I going to get it? They said, how would you get alcohol if you're underage now anyway? I said, I'd sit there, wait at the liquor store, and then ask somebody to give him cash and get me the beer or something. He goes, well, that's how you're going to do it now. So I started doing that. And I was like sitting there with Andre's $100 bill, hoping I wasn't going to, you know, get robbed of, like, you know, this guy not coming back out with his, it had to be right. French wine. It had to be like this French wine. I believe it was like a Stoli vodka he drank. Mm-hmm. And it was only certain things that he drank, you know, but when I came through and he tipped me $50, I'd be like, thanks, kid. You know, and I'm like, this raise is dumb. Thanks, kid. Playing cards. I'd be like, no problem, Andre. Yes, boss.
Would he give you a tip or anything like that?
Oh, yeah. He used to tip me heavy. Yeah. Oh, yeah. Definitely.
I used to buy beer when I was not even of age yet, but the guy most of the time would just take your money, walk in one door and walk out the other side. You'd never see him again.
Right. That's what you're so worried about. Right. And I got to go back to this guy that's 7 foot, 520 pounds. And I'm like, oh, I'm like, I'm going to kill the boys if I lose this money because they're telling me to go do this.
So talk about your road schedule back then, because that's when it was, I mean, I'm just thinking you've seen everybody come and go in there from Andre all the way up now to, you know, Drew McIntyre and everyone in between. So what was the schedule like back in 1985, 86, when you started on the road?
Yeah, the schedule was tough. That's something that you definitely sacrificed home stuff. Like Tony Chimlin and I, we're on the road for like at least 280, sometimes 300 days a year.
That's insane. And that's no exaggeration. That's a shoot, right?
No, that's a shoot.
Yeah.
That is a complete shoot. Because, I mean, for the first 11 or 12, I want to say 11, 12 years, like, I remember getting a call from Chimel after 12 years. We did, on Thanksgiving Day, we did Survivor Series in Richfield, Ohio. Mm-hmm. And we weren't home for, like, 12 years on Thanksgiving Day because we used to have to leave on, like,
right.
Monday or Tuesday to set up in Richfield, drive 8-9 hours there from Jersey. And then, I mean, we were on the road constantly. And then, like, Europe tours, when we started those, we'd do 17 days in Germany alone, you know, and in buses and everything, you know. Those were some fun trips in Germany and everywhere in England and every, you know, around the world. So, yeah, I mean, we had to set up the ring, get prepared, do everything during the show. And then once I started refereeing and all that, you had to tear down the ring, drive the truck, go to the next down. And there was at times that we had double shots. I don't know if you remember them back in it.
Oh, yeah, yeah.
We had the double shots where we had one show at 1 o'clock in Syracuse and then like another show at 7:30, 8 o'clock in Utica, New York. So we'd break down quick, get to the hockey arena, and then boom, set back up and do the show again. But it was great because it was double pay.
Right.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to keepitfunohio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Let's talk about some of those tours back in the days. I mean, the 80s had some pretty colorful characters. Who were some of the guys that stood out as being kind of the more more raucous and crazy out of the dudes that were there?
Yeah, definitely. Like, I remember, like, God, I used to love to go out at night. Like, and I've had a few nicknames in this business in over three decades that I've been with the business. And it started out.
Kiki the Optimist.
Kiki the Optimist, right? And I know, right? And I love when you say that. You've always said that, Kiki the Optimist. And that's true, man. You got to be optimist. I always remember saying, oh, my God, there's another place to go somewhere, you know? Like,
yeah. So when you used to go back in those days, you had some nicknames. What did it start out with?
It started off with Coyote. Mm-hmm. Razor Ramon and Hulk Hogan, they started me off with Coyote back in the day. So, and I remember I was like, he was like, I'm nicknaming you Coyote because every time you're just howling at the moon at night after the show, just always chasing that moon. So that stuck for a while. And then I guess when The Rock came around, he goes, Coyote? He goes, no, I don't like that nickname. I like Chi-Chi. I said, Chi-Chi? I said, oh, I don't kind of like that. He goes, that's too bad. You're stuck with Chi-Chi. Whatever The Rock said went, you know?
Yeah.
So, and then Chi-Chi came around. But then it came like Kiki. I think a lot of the unbelievable female talent in this business, they started that some years ago. So they wound up turning around and one of the girls were like, Kiki, and it just stuck, you know?
I remember when, because we used to work together quite a bit, you and me and The Rock, you were always our referee, and it was Chi-Chi. And then when I left for a couple years and came back, everyone's saying Kiki. I'm like, no, it's Chi-Chi. It's like, Chi-Chi, what are you talking about? I'm like, Kiki, what are you talking about?
Right.
So somewhere
right.
There was a little bit of a change in those few years.
That was the truth. That's the truth, too. That is definitely the truth because some of the guys come back and they go, well, who's Kiki? You know? Yeah. Oh, it's Coyote. Oh, well, when's his name become Kiki? You know? And even Shane, when Shane came back and we were doing Taker's match and AJ, you know, I remember he was coming back and he said, hey, this match is huge for me. And, you know, I want you to be my referee. And I was always kind of Shane's referee, too, as well. When he came back, they said, oh, well, Kiki will ref your match. And he's Kiki. Who the hell's Kiki? And he comes up to me, goes, who the hell gave you that nickname? I said, I know. I said, you know, people give you nicknames, I guess. You just don't choose them, you know?
Right.
So
who were some of the guys that you worked with quite exclusively that kind of wanted you to be their ref all the time?
I remember back in the day, it was Brett on house shows and stuff like that and TVs and stuff like that. After Joey was gone, Bret Hart, there was a lot of guys like The Rock wanted me to do matches for his. And I mean, I remember like even Brock Lesnar and certain guys have asked for me at them times in certain matches. And, you know, it was always a good thing when Michael Hayes came to me and said, they want you to be the referee in this match. And so it was a ton of talent over the years.
Well, it's a big deal to have the right ref because you have to trust the guys that you're working with, you know, or in this case, in AEW girls, the Aubie Edwards is the one I always request because you have to have a certain chemistry with somebody and know that they're going to be in the right place at the right time or not be at the right in the wrong place. There's a real style to it. What's your kind of your theory on how to be a good referee?
A theory on it, definitely. to know how to feel the crowd. You have to feel the crowd. You have to feel the ring when you're taking a bump in certain spots. You may not have nothing to feed off of, like whether it's a big screen off the monitor or, you know, you got to either feel the crowd, what's going on in the ring by yourself, or you got to feel the bump that you know where the crowd's going to react to, where you know your spot's coming back up to come out of a bump. Mm-hmm. You have to be at the right time. You have to definitely be there, because as much as you guys work so hard, Chris, the referee has to be there at certain spots and has to definitely know what's going on with experience. You know, as far as, I think a good referee is not seen so much, if you quite understand what I'm saying there. He's only there when he's supposed to be, you know. Mm-hmm. When a referee is seen too much or too noticed, I mean, that's what Gorilla Monsoon and Pat Patterson, a lot of people say, when you don't notice the referee in that match, the referee has done his job. Mm-hmm. So, and of course, you do need to know how to work with both talent, I think. You know, it's I see referees used to always go up to one guy. I'd say, make sure you get with the heel. Make sure you know how to work around the heel and how he wants you to work around him with his spots and with him getting his heat or anything. And the same way with the babyface. Just don't put it to one guy. Get everything how they want you to work with them. And you got to put your input to protect yourself as a referee.
No, I mean, and that's a great point. And let me ask you this, being there for decades and decades, what were kind of the rules that were given to you as a referee throughout the years? Because I know that Vince would change his mind seemingly every 6 months as to what's legal and what's not legal. Tell us about some of those restrictions and things that happened.
Well, the rules, I mean, like when I grew up in this business, when it was like, you know, when I seen Dino Bravo come in and a lot of guys and you know, Shawn Michaels and everything and the Rougeau brothers and the British Bulldogs, you know, like a referee, the rules with them inside the ring is that you had to be there. If there was a tag match and there's a baby face coming in, steaming in to get the heel on a spot. And if you didn't cut him off, they would be hot at you. You know, there were certain spots to where, because you would make a baby face look stupid if he got to the heel. You know,
right.
On certain heat spots and stuff like that, because, you know, they always say, don't let me get to him, you know, and if you do, you know,
right.
So, you know, and there's a lot of things with false finishes, keeping close counts, the rules in the business now definitely have changed, but I see rules, they kind of just, one day it's this rule and then the next day it's something else, you know. You know, with the rules, as far as the 5 count with these days is very strict. Mm-hmm. The 10 count is very strict, but then that's played with, you know, on and off. Counting shoulder to shoulder is a very strict rule as far as, you know, pinfalls and everything.
How do you mean? Making sure that the shoulders are actually down?
That's correct. Yeah, all shoulders are down. If one shoulder's up, you shouldn't count it. And there's certain things where referees have definitely got to give cues. I mean, cues are huge. Spot calling. I think spot calling is what I learned when I first was in the business, started refereeing, was spot calling, you know, back to talent to talent. And that's something I was always, you know, very well at doing.
Yes. And I use my referee quite a bit to relay messages, you know, and you have to be able to trust the guy, because a lot of times you don't have, you know, 20 seconds to, you know, tell him to get up on the ropes, and then he's going to stay. You just got to say, hey, tell him to watch, or tell him to look over here, or,
right,
you know, get his attention or something like that. You know, very quick.
Right. Yeah. Like when I grew up, and I try to tell refs a lot too these days, like when somebody climbs up to the top rope to drop kick him and the other guy's selling on the, you know, I grew up to where it was like the wrestler used to use me and say, okay, is he up? And I'd be like, he's up. He's ready. He's ready. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Because, you know, he didn't want to look back or look under his arm or, you know, when he's selling a big spot where he's trying to get up to his feet, and I'm his cue. I'm, you know, I'm helping him help me too as well. And I'm like, hey, okay, he's up on the ropes. He's ready. You know, and that's something like, you know, I do want to drive by or something just to let him know. So, because they never wanted to look back and look under their shoulders or anything like that. So, and that's communication between a referee and a wrestler is huge in the ring.
So you mentioned before, like, as far as, you know, counting the shoulders down and that sort of thing, was there ever circumstances, and tell us if there was, where you had to count to three when it wasn't supposed to be the finish because the guy didn't kick out.
Oh, yes.
Was there ever time? Yeah, tell us what happened there.
Yeah, there was not too long ago, a couple of years ago, with Shinsuke Nakamura and R-Truth. And I remember Ronnie goes, he small packaged him one time. And then he only told me he was going to small package him again, but then he small packaged him the second time or something. The first time. Mm-hmm. And he was supposed to small package him twice. And then like Shinsuke didn't like really almost kick out or something. And I'm like, I counted three. And Ronnie goes, that wasn't the finish. He goes, I was supposed to small package him again. I said, why would you small package him twice? I was like, you told me once in the back. He goes, oh, my bad, dog. I'm sorry. But he had won the title. So it was kind of funny there. And yeah, there's quite a few times where I've had to count three on certain situations where guys just didn't kick out or counted 10 when they're outside the ring.
Do you get heat from the guys when that happens?
Back in the day, you would get heat, but not these days. You didn't get heat. They may be hot, but if they didn't kick out or they didn't get back in the ring and it counted 10, that's their own fault,
Well, and you're going to get heat if you don't count them.
That's correct. Yeah, you get heat from the office, most definitely. I mean, you'll get a lot of heat in Gorilla. So, you have to do your job and you have to pretty much straight and forward do your job all the way through with the rules. Well, even though there is no rule book yet.
We're still waiting for that.
Thinking about writing one.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
So what kind of interactions did you have with Vince over the years?
Over the years, it's just been, how you doing, Vince? How are you, sir? And he'd be like, Mike, how's everything going? Everybody good? Your family good? Yes, sir. It was always a good relationship on the fly. Vince is a very busy man. Every time years ago, we had more conversations than anything. Not so many in the last so many years, but Vince really kind of comes out of the office, goes to Gorilla, and then, and he'll be there for some rehearsals or so forth. But my relationship with Vince was awesome over 35 years.
Was there ever a time when he gave you specific instructions, like, hey, Mike, I need you to do this. Go out there and make sure this happens?
Yes. He said, I need you to put these rules into effect, a lot of rules, and help this young talent, period. And I don't care. Whatever you do, I will back you up, So he used to always tell me, like, make sure you if you have to count him out, I don't give a damn. You do your job in that ring and make them work around you. Mm-hmm. There's times I did that, so.
How was it over the years because for a while you're referee Mike Chioda, and then there's a time when Vince doesn't want to announce any referees' names, so you're just the referee. What did you think about that?
Yeah, that was, I didn't get that because I believe it was they were kind of saying my name too much and the referee's name too much. Mm-hmm. And I remember it wasn't with me though, but it was with another referee, which he didn't recognize their name. And he was kind of like, who is this? Who's this? Whose name is this? And they said, oh, it's the referee. And he goes, well, God damn it. He was like, I'm done hearing the referee's name. I don't want to hear their names no more, So I was like, well, thanks to that ref. I was like, well, they were putting his name over too much, and he didn't recognize the referee's name, I believe. That's what I was told.
And that's a classic Vince. He sees one name he doesn't recognize, and suddenly everybody's name can never be mentioned again.
That's it. Done.
Until he goes, why are we mentioning the ref's name, damn it?
Right. Why are we right? Referees, they don't sell tickets, they comp tickets.
So let's go back to when you first started in the 80s in that crazy time frame. How was the business changing around then? Because you mentioned you started in 85, 86, and suddenly there's this huge expansion to where Vince is taking over all the territories.
Yeah. God, when we first started, Tony Chimel and I and everything on the ring crews and stuff, I mean, Chris, we played music at a show, not at TVs, but at all the live events, we played music through a dual cassette boombox. Mm-hmm. And we'd have the microphone for Tony Chimel for ring announcer. We'd have a backup mic. Then we'd have a hard mic that would just, you put it right up to the boombox. And like, at first I had this one cassette player boombox. And then when I had two cassettes, it was like, oh my God, I moved up in the world. I could play two cassettes right after another.
Right.
So, and I remember the tapes used to get stuck and everything, and a Chief J. Strombo or Jack Lanza, Rene Goulet, they'd come walking down the aisle and I'm trying to play Hogan's music or something. And the tape, I'd be pulling the tape out, trying to put it back in. Then the tape would like string out to like 20 inches long because it's stuck somewhere. And Hogan would have to come out with no music. The change has been huge. I mean, from what we started doing on live events and even on TVs is where we're at now is just, it's a huge, huge, huge difference. It's unbelievable.
Sometimes you see like either fights break out in the ring between the guys or there's fan. Did you ever have to get caught in the middle of any of those in the ring or in the dressing room?
Yeah, I've been caught through a lot of those. They called what, receipts, and he potatoed the shit out of me.
Out of you?
No, I mean, when the boys, when like one guy, you know, one of the boys would potato somebody else. And I mean, there was one thing with, you know, remember the Rougeaus and the British Bulldog and Dynamite Kid. And I was in this, we were in this elementary school down in the locker room. And I just got done refereeing the match. And they were hot at each other. And then next thing you know, like Dynamite just smacked, you know, Jacques Rougeau, you know. Mm-hmm. And then it started a big fight there. And it was just a kind of, it wasn't even really a fight. It was just, he kind of smacked him and he knocked him out, cold out, Jacques Rougeau. And I was like, oh my God, because I liked both them guys. I mean, Raymond and Jacques were great guys and, you know, Bulldog and Dynamite Kid, you know. Mm-hmm. That was one of the most, the big fights that I've witnessed, you know.
Well, that's the famous one too, where the Rougeaus got the receipt on Dynamite, but they knocked his teeth out with a roll of quarters and all that whole thing.
That's right. It followed up. Yep, it sure did. They did get the receipt on that.
Isn't it amazing how the business has changed? Like, you would never have guys stalking each other in the dressing room now to knock each other out with a roll of quarters, you know, breaking teeth and breaking noses. Like, it really was so much more Wild West back then.
Oof, Wild, Wild West. You had to watch yourself all the time. You had to watch getting your head shaved on the road, on the overseas tours. You had to, when you fall asleep, your eyebrows. You had to watch everything, you know? Yeah, I remember there's so many ribs back in the day. You used to have to watch your gear when you went in the ring. And I remember like you'd see people's like shoelaces cut and one pant leg cut off and cut back. The boys would be hot. I mean, there were so many ribs going on back in the day, but I loved it. I survived it.
So tell us who are some of the worst ribbers and some of the things they would do.
Oh my God. Owen Hart. He would, when I used to play the music, you know, on the crew and everything, you know, like the match would be going on. I'd walk away from the headset and like, this is when we stepped up a notch because we were starting to play music from the headset backstage at like by the ramp side where, you know, the wrestlers would go in and out.
Right.
So this is when we stepped up from a boombox with a microphone and the headset needed back. And if I had to go to the bathroom for like 3 minutes and I knew I had 10, 15 more minutes in this match, I'd be in the bathroom and I hear the music going. I'd be like, what the hell is that? So next thing I run back over to the headsets in the back and, you know, here comes Jack Lanza. Hey, what the F is going on there, Kyoto? Why are you playing the music? I'm like, I didn't touch the music. You know, I'd get on the headset. Hey, why are you playing the music during the match? He goes, you just got on here and told me to hit the music. I said, what? I didn't do that shit. You know, like, I'm like, I didn't say anything. I wasn't even on the headset. He was like, you just got on 2 minutes ago and said, hit the music. So I'm look over. Who's down the hallway? Oh, and with a grin. But back in those days, Chris, if you didn't see anybody pull the rib, you couldn't accuse him for it.
Those guys were masters at that, right?
Yeah, they were masters. I mean, they'd send pizzas to your room on the overseas tour, like 10 pizzas or all these meals, and like you'd have to pay for it. And you'd be like, I didn't order this. What's wrong with you? You know, like, I'm not paying for this. And you'd have like 10 spaghetti bowls in your room, at your room, you know, like, what the hell, you know? I remember there was this one time with Davey Boy. I was sitting there and, you know, he'd go up and down that tour bus, up and down, and he used to wear a baseball cap, sunglasses, and I'd be like, and you're all hungover from going out till 5-6 in the morning, you know? Mm-hmm. And you're on this 6-7 hour bus ride. And he turns, you know, like, I remember him just like up and down, grinning, you know? And I'm like, God, I got to always watch out for him. So then I fell asleep for a while. Then all of a sudden, we get to the town. Bret Hart sitting there next to me. He's in, I'm washing my face and everything. And I look up, and Bret's next to me. He's washing his face. He's doing something in the, you know, at the sink. And I look in the mirror, and I go, holy shit, what happened to my eyebrow? I'm like, so my one eyebrow is, like, almost completely gone. And I'm like, damn it. I'm like, I kept watching Davey the whole time. I only fell asleep for a little bit, you know. But I didn't see him do it, but I kind of knew it was him, you know. So I'm like, Bret, man, what am I going to do with this? He's like, all right, let me see. He goes, and he was like an artist. Bret did a lot of art drawing and stuff, you know. Mm-hmm. So he's like, let me see if this works. So we try to color it back in. He goes, nah, that's not going to work, Coyote. I was like, oh, Bret, what do you? I was like, yeah, that looks stupid. I was like, what do I do now? He's like, you got to shave the other one. I'm like, what? And he's like, you got to shave the other one. He's like, let me help you out. So he gets the razor. He shaves the other one. And then Davey Boy walks by and he goes, he starts laughing. And I'm like, oh, real funny, huh, Davey Boy? He's like, what happened to the other one? And I said, I don't know. What happened to the first one, Davey? And he's like, I don't know. You know, he's like, what are you saying? I did it? I said, no, I'm not saying that, Davey. I was just, you know, wondering. He goes, Jesus. He goes, you ribbed yourself now. I said, oh, whatever. Walked around with no eyebrows for a while.
The Calgary guys were brutal, and so was Kurt Hennig, this terrible Rivers.
Yes, Kurt. He was another River, exactly. Yes. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, that was, God, it was, I think it was with Kurt and Brock Lesnar in a fight in a plane, too, back in the day.
Were you on that plane? You remember that one, the plane ride from death?
Yes.
That's the one where Brock and Kurt got in a fight right next to the exit door. I mean, this is like 20,000 feet up. And yep. I think Waltman cut off PS's ponytail.
Yes, he cut his ponytail off. I remember that. Oh, my God. Yeah, that was some days. And, you know, it was a charter flight then, too. I think it was a charter flight. Was it? Or was it? No, it was business class.
No, it was charter because they used to have us go do those pay-per-views where we'd go to England for a day and we'd land in England at like, you know, noon, sleep until like 6, do the show, get back on the plane and come right home again. Like, what are you just asking for trouble when you do that?
Right. Exactly. Pushing the boys to the extent. But yeah, those days were fun though. I got to say they were a lot of fun, Chris.
Well, and those guys were like ninjas too. They could walk by and just do a quick slip and suddenly you lost a razor. It wasn't like, no, it was just for people listening. It wasn't like there was a big long production with, you know, shaving cream or whatever. They would just come with the razor down to zero and just go, and you wouldn't even know it.
That's, you wouldn't even know it. I remember the boys, we were on a commercial flight one day and it was Bulldog and a couple of the other boys, but there was a bunch of drunk college kids on the plane and they were talking like, oh, wrestling's so fake and wrestling's this. And these kids were drunk, all college kids coming from some spring break or something. Well, as they were getting off the plane, one had half a head. I remember like four of the guys had no hair left and it was just blotchied. All their heads were shaved. And I looked at them, I went, holy shit, who did this? I'm like, and these kids were crying coming off the plane. And one of them was even a girl. She had half her head shaved, and she was, yeah, it was pretty fun.
How were you doing this with nobody seeing?
Oh, I'll tell you, if there was somebody seeing, nobody would say nothing, you know?
Right.
Because you didn't stooge anybody back in them days, you know? That's one thing Gorilla Monsoon always said. He was like, let me tell you one thing. Anybody ever wants you to stooge in this business, then you're not doing your job right. You need to go find another job. Because if you need to stooge on the boys or anybody, then you're just not doing your job good enough.
Yeah.
You know?
There's a real code of honor amongst all of us, gypsies, tramps, and thieves, right?
Yes, sir. You got it, Chris. That is the truth, brother.
The longest field goal ever attempted is 76 yards. The longest field goal ever missed? Also 76 yards. Why bring this up? Because knowing your limits matters, both when you're kicking a field goal and when you gamble. Betting more than you're comfortable with is like trying a 70-yard field goal. It probably won't go well. So set a limit when you gamble and stick to it. Want more helpful tips like this? Go to KeepItFunOhio.com for games, quizzes, and lots of ways to keep your gambling from getting out of hand.
Speaking of the code of honor, were you ever in the ring when a fan hit the ring?
Yeah, yeah. Quite a few times. The most memorable one was Stone Cold Steve Austin, Triple H. And I remember we were all bumped. We all took a bump at that time. I took a bump. I was laid out. And then, you know, it's at certain points as a referee, you have to make sure your head's turned the other way, the opposite, where the spot's going to go down. Mm-hmm. So now all three of us are down, and I hear something in the ring. And I'm like, wait a minute, what's going on? Because I feel the ring, moving and bouncing a little bit. And somebody's stomping, and I'm like, who the hell came out of a dead cell and started, you know, getting on the other guy? It was supposed to be laid out for a while, you know?
Right.
And I look over, and there's this fan in the ring, all of a sudden, stomping on Stone Cold, you know, and boom, we all came out of this dead cell, you know? And I remember Hunter grabs him, and I'm trying to kick the guy, and I'm trying to kick him and everything and punch him where, trying not to hit Triple H. And I remember it was in Germany. We were in Germany somewhere. And I remember when they brought him back to the back and security had him. And all he was trying to do was protect China, because China was on the outside. And I remember him going, China, I love you. I just tried to protect you. And then China just walked right up and kicked him straight in the nuts. And she goes, I could protect myself, buddy. And he just drops to his knees. He's like, oh. And I'm just like, oh.
Yeah, it was never a smart idea for those dudes walking in the ring. You know what I mean? It's a no-win situation.
That's true. That's true.
Because you'll always see the guys, it don't matter, heel, babyface, ref. One time I had the doc involved. Whoever's just around ringside, it's just open season, fresh meat, kill them.
Yeah, yeah, definitely. That's it. But these days, I think it's a little bit different because, God forbid, if you did something, they'd probably countersue you or do something, you know? But back in the days, it was, if you got in that ring, it was that's your ass, you know?
Well, you'd even have the guy brought backstage for a little meeting sometimes.
That's right. That's right. You bring him back and, yep, teach him really how to be a man. You know, I remember Haku was the head shrinkers, or let's see, it was Haku and Tonga.
The Islanders.
Yeah, Islanders back in the day. And we were in we were Jaffa Mosque in Altoona, PA, I want to say.
Oh,
it was
my
gosh,
the mosque.
Yeah, the mosque.
The weirdest place for a match.
Yes, yes. And so I remember Tonga was pretty, he was a pretty wild Samoan. He was a great guy, though. Great guy. And he took somebody back. He made us get somebody backstage because this guy jumped in the ring. And then he actually, slapped him on the back. So at the end of the match, I said, tell that guy we want to see him. So he wound up taking him down with some throat thing and took him right down to the ground and put his knee on his head and says, you want me to teach you how to be a man? You want to hit somebody? Hit me now, you know? And I was like, woo, man, mess with the boys. I'll tell you that.
We got in you were probably even there in one of those trips to Japan. Remember that one trip we talked about, charter planes, where they charter the entire crew to Japan.
Yes.
And I mean, we had like a Raw taping and a SmackDown taping one after another. It's like, oh my gosh, that was just so insane, that trip. I remember that's when that old security guard, Jimmy, what's his name, passed out. And
Jimmy Tillis or?
Jimmy Tillis.
Oh, you remember? He got his head stuck in the bus one time, I remember.
That's right. That's what I'm talking about, remember?
Oh, it is. Okay. Yeah, I remember that. Yeah, Shane was on that bus. I remember he was so drunk and something happened. He got his head stuck in some like metal piece or something. Some like cart, like he was, I think it was a holder for luggage or something on those buses in Japan. And he got his head stuck and we couldn't get him out for the longest time.
I remember when he finally woke up, I'm like, I said, Mike Chioda is the new head of security for the WWE. Because you are the one able to get him out.
Kiki the optimistic.
That's right. I was just going to say, we're at one of those things in Japan where there's some kind of a bar fight. And this is when Haku came back in about 2002, kind of for his last run. And it was one of those ones where I knew how crazy he was and all of us did. But he was a mild-mannered, you know, family man then. But all it took was one little indication that one of the boys is in trouble, and he was over there goozling all the Marines and taking them all down and calming the situation, you know, that old school code of honor that we talked about.
Yes, and I remember that when he took them all down, he told me, I believe it was Torrie Wilson, and I want to say Stacy Keibler that was with us.
Yeah.
And then he made me, you take the girls and you get the girls outside the club,
right,
and do it now. And I was like, yeah, but I want to help you because I want you to take care of the girls and get them outside safe now. And I said, okay, brother, you got it. And the next thing you know, all this shit, I missed everything, you know, but I started seeing them go to town on somebody, but I was like, Keebs, Tori, we got to go right now, you know?
Yeah.
So, you know, I definitely did my part, you know, what he told me to do, but I kind of missed everything, you know, and we got to go.
Let's talk about, you know, once again, being in the ring for pretty much the entire modern generation of the WWE. Who were some of the most popular guys that you were ever in the ring with? And I know you're going to understand what I mean, because you can watch it at home on TV as a fan or in the arena, but when you're standing in the ring, there's a whole different sound that you hear and that you experience. Who were some of the biggest names that you were in the ring with?
You mean modern or all?
I mean, from 85 to now, the most popular, you know, it's like when they came out, the place would go crazy.
Yeah. Like, I would have to say, like, when I first started with Hulk Hogan was the most impressive.
Right.
Andre, when he even came out to the ring back in the day when I was a kid, it was just a different kind of pop. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah.
It was kind of like, whoa, like, holy crap, you know, like, and they used to rise, but it was just, I'd have to say Hulk Hogan is one guy that I've seen. He used to have kids crying through the barricades, the old bicycle racks. Crying, and when he's selling and selling and selling, it was just amazing to see these people going nuts. And like when he entered the entrance, when his music used to hit, the crowd used to go just nuts.
Yeah.
And I have to say that Bret Hart had a huge impact on his entrance on me when I'd be in the ring.
That's cool.
There was so many guys. I mean, I there were so many guys back in the day, and then of course The Rock, of course, yourself too, Chris.
Hmm. Thanks, man.
I mean, really, you know, your entrance music and you're larger than life. Some other guys. And CM Punk was he had this charisma where he came out even with his music. Mm-hmm. It was just larger than life, you know? And there's been many guys. I mean, of course, like The Rock, Hogan, back in the day, I'd have to say Triple H, even, you know, just there's so many talent that's on and off.
It's funny, we keep mentioning the connection with The Rock and yourself and myself. Remember that tour that we did? It was one of my favorite tours ever when we went to Japan and Singapore and Malaysia.
Yes.
And it was right after I won the title. So they put me and Rock on top. It's right before Rock basically left because he was promoting the Scorpion King, and he wanted to be over in the Orient for that. Remember that?
Yeah, I remember that. Oh,
and
yeah.
I had some kind of issue with Earl Hebner, because I think I had yelled at his son Brian for something up, and so Earl was mad at me. He's like, I'm not ruffling their matches. And you're like, and we're like, all right, let's get Chi-Chi in there.
Yeah, I remember that.
You don't want to ref the main event? Well, then we'll get Mike in there. And we had the best time.
Yeah, one of my most favorable, like, it wasn't wrestling really, but took a couple bumps, had a couple spots, was with the 6-man tag with you, The Rock, and the Dudley Boys and Nick Patrick, you know?
Now, here's something funny. You know, that's something, you know, you've been doing this for a long time and you completely forget. And I had just seen somebody mention that or something like that just recently. So I went back and checked it out. I totally forgot about that. So tell us about what you remember about that match.
Shoot, I haven't forgot about that day, Chris.
Was that your only match you ever had?
That was my only match I ever had in the ring.
Well, let's talk about it. What happened? Tell us the story.
Yeah, man. I mean, hey, I was when they told me that day I was going to be in a 6-man tag, I said, who, me? I said, doing what? They were like, wrestling. You're going to be in a 6-man tag tonight with Chris Y2J, Chris Jericho, and The Rock against the Dudleys and Nick Patrick. So I'm like, oh, my, okay, great, man. I'm like, holy shit. I'm like, I better get my game on. I'm like, I better, you know, not mess nothing up here. I got a few spots. And I remember Bubba coming up to me, and I had to take a clothesline, right?
Yeah.
Bubba. I did a few spots and everything with Nick Patrick in the ring, and I turn around. I know I had to take a clothesline from Bubba. And he goes, I remember him coming up to me. He goes, Kyoto, if you don't fucking sell this bump, he goes, you're a referee. You're not one of the boys. He goes, you better sell the shit out of this bump. And I'm like, no problem, Bubba. No problem, Bubba. I got you. I'm selling. Well, Chris, when he gave me that clothesline, there was no selling, period, because he stiffed the shit out of me so bad. If you ever watch that, I held my shoulder all the way till I got back to the back.
You know? I remember you had to wear your ref clothes.
Right. I had to wear the ref shirt and everything, you know. And even through the spot when I gave the people's elbow and everything and all that, I was still holding the shoulder. And he comes, and then I come to the back in the locker room, and he goes, you oversold a little bit, but overselling is better than underselling. But it was good. Thank you, Kyoto.
I think that's when we were doing the invasion versus the WWE or whatever it may be. So Nick Patrick was kind of the anti-WWE ref, and you, of course, were Mr. WWE ref. So that's why you're in the match. It's funny because the other ref was another guy who's been there for a long time, Timmy White.
Yeah, Tim White was the referee, exactly. And I love Tim White, man. He actually called me a couple months ago so to see how I was doing and all that. So, because I was out for surgery for a while. So he was like, man, I feel your pain, what you're going through, you know. And he was just checking on me because he had rotator cuff problems years ago.
Well, let's talk about that, too. When you're like, you know, you talk about being a referee, and you are called to take bumps or to have matches or you know, but just the point of counting to three with that shoulder, like Timmy's shoulder went out, that kind of ended his career. And you tell me you just had rotator cuff. It's more physical than people might expect to be an official in pro wrestling.
Oh yeah, definitely. I mean, it lasted a long time. What happened was I took a bump. It was probably about 7-8 months ago. I got pulled out of the ring, and it was a spot where one of the outside, like the managers or, you know, the enforcer on the outside, and he pulled me out of the ring, and I kind of, instead of taking a belly bump or anything on the mat, I kind of landed on my shoulder a little bit twisted, you know, which is, you know, you never know which way you're going to land when you take a bump. So I tore my rotator cuff at that point, but then I continued the referee for a while, and they thought it was a deep bruise. And so then I did some gauntlet matches, like 1 week for an hour. Then the next week I did another gauntlet match for an hour. And then it was still good to go. But I felt that after the second gauntlet match I did, I cooled down for about an hour or so. And then I had to wait for like 2:05 to get done. And then I did this dark match at like 11 o'clock at night. And after cooling down and everything, and then boom, I think I tore my bicep right there. So at that point, that's where I went on to get surgery for rotator cuff and bicep. So, but it's all good to go now. I'm back. I feel great.
Well, like you said, I mean, there's some wear and tear there, but you know, it's actually funny. I had the match playing in the background. I just saw that clothesline. Yeah, that wasn't a clothesline. That was basically a punch to the face from Bubba Dudley to you.
Oh yeah, yeah, right. Exactly. Because, I mean, I felt that. I felt that, really. I was like, there was nothing to really sell. I was definitely potatoed.
So let me, as we start to wind down here, let me ask you about, you know, what is the differentiation between being one of the boys and being in the office? Because we had so many great times together. You know, I'm going to ask you who you travel with, who some of your favorite guys to travel with were, but were you ever considered to be part of the office or referees part of the boys?
Well, I wanted to be referee part of the boys, you know?
Yeah.
I was never an office guy, Chris. I lived my life with amazing different guys and talents and the boys throughout the 35 years I was doing this. All the boys were my family, you know?
Right.
I spent all the time on the road with the boys, and my job was to be on the road with the boys, you know? And it's just, I just never felt like I was an office guy, mm-hmm. you know? I actually wanted, you know, definitely at some point later on down the road to train referees. And, you know, like I said, I still have a lot left in me inside the ring and outside where I could provide my knowledge and my experience and stuff, what I've learned over the course of years.
Who were some of your favorite guys that you traveled with?
There's a bunch, you know, like back in the day with Joey Morella, I used to travel with him a lot. And Tony Chimmel, when I first started. After that, when I became just a referee, you know, I would travel. I had great times with Test. I used to travel with Test a lot. Mm. And he was a lot of fun to travel with over the years. R-Truth, traveled with R-Truth a lot. Jack Swagger, traveled with him.
Ray
Mysterio all the time. Umanga was a very close friend, loved to travel with. It would be me, Ray, Umanga, Johnny Stamboli. Remember him? Skiducci. And yeah. And it was a lot of guys. Epico and Primo.
Great guys. Love those guys.
Yeah, I love them. And yeah, they're shit disturbers too. You got to watch them.
Remember that time we were in Dubai together and the guy threatened, he put a bounty on my head to...
Yeah, remember that guy? he had his shirt down like a Guido with chains and everything, and he's pulling. He had that Hummer outside, and he's going, "I'll get you," and you, I got a bounty on your head. He was telling you that. I said, and then we're sitting there going, "Oh shit, are we gonna be all right when we go back to the hotel, or is this guy gonna?" You know.
He said because he was being kind of a jerk, so I said, "Watch this." And I walked by and gave him the old hip check into the wall, like, "Oh, sorry, buddy." Yes. And he said he's put a bounty on my head for $7 million. You'll be dead in 24 hours, $7 million. And I remember I said to Swagger, is that good? Like, is that a lot of money for a bounty, or is it, do we need, like, is if I was like Mel Gibson or, you know, like Brad Pitt, would it be $30 million? Like, how much is $7
million? Yeah, right.
So then the next day we go to work and we're doing some stuff, whatever we're doing there. And I think I had some meet and greets or something. And then I was like, you know what? I'm just going to play it safe. I got 24 hours to live. It's been about 20. I'm not going to go out tonight. And then do you remember you sent me a picture to my phone? Do you remember what the picture was?
No, I do not.
A giant bottle of Grey Goose.
Oh, that. Yes. Okay. Yes. I remember they were selling those big bottle. They were selling those big bottles with sparklers.
And you're like, hey, look what we got. And I was like, all right, I got to go. So I go to the club and I see the bouncer and he goes, oh, you're still alive. And I said, like, am I okay? He says, no, that guy talks shit every weekend. He puts a bounty on somebody's head. He says he works down the street at the liquor store or whatever.
Yeah, that was a nice club. That was off some boat marina. Remember that? Right off some boat and all the shots, you know?
What were some of your favorite cities to go to? Because you mentioned you always like to go out, and so did I. And we always had kind of a crew that would like to go and see things.
Like Japan was one of my favorite. Mm-hmm. Roppongi was the best to go to, I thought. You know, that was real fun. I mean, if you didn't go to, you had, when you went to Japan, you had to go to Roppongi, right?
Yeah.
I mean, it was something you had to do. And even Shinjuku and a lot of places in Japan. Australia is one of my favorites. Sydney and Melbourne. It was just, we used to get back to the hotel at like noon and the club would still be going on. I mean, we'd go at it like midnight, you know. Of course, by the time we got back, we wouldn't get out to like 12 or 1 o'clock in the morning. And then we'd go to these clubs in Australia. And like, I remember dancing with some girl and I'm sitting there And it's like, boom, 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 boom. The music's still going. And all of a sudden, one of the boys like, hey, we got to go. Kyoto, we got to go. I'm like, what time is it, love? She's like, it's 11 o'clock in the morning, love. And I'm like, what? So I remember the first, when I walked out, it was like 11:30 and the cars were all and brights. It was sunny. So I'm like, okay, I get it. So now when I go out in Australia, I got to bring a pair of sunglasses with me. Not when I go in, it's when I come out.
You know? A couple of names that you mentioned that just talk about briefly, because their careers were cut short. Talking about Test and Joey Morella. A lot of people don't remember those guys. Let's talk a little bit about Joey Morella.
Definitely. Joey Morella, man. I grew up with him. He loved everything I did. I mean, we had such a great relationship. It was just, he loved the fish. He played baseball. I played baseball. He loved hockey. I loved hockey. We loved football. We loved all sports. We used to travel together. We were growing up having so much fun. We used to hang out at home. And as soon as we came home off the road, we'd get together after we pay bills for one day and get some stuff together. And we'd start hanging out at home for a couple of days that we had at home. And we both played baseball and just had a lot of things in common, me and Joey, on the road. There was a lot of good stories with Joey, too, man. A lot of funny stories. So,
such a drag, because it's the one thing that we all kind of dread, you know, whatever it was, falling asleep at the wheel or whatever and having a car crash. And that's what happened with Joey, just on the road doing his job, right?
That's correct. Yeah, Chris, it was just sad. God bless Joey, man, and miss him very much. Yeah, it was we were coming off a 17-day road trip.
Jeez.
And I remember we were coming back from Salisbury, Maryland, and we had to, he had to drive all, we were driving the ring crew truck back, Tony Chimel and I, and back to South Jersey. And we were just finishing off a 17-day run. And he had to drive back to Newark, New Jersey, which was probably, he passed so many different airports at that time, BWI, Washington, I think, BWI, Philadelphia. And then was continuing on. He actually got in an accident with Bruno Harvey Wimple back then.
Yeah, yeah.
And he actually had the accident right by his mother's exit, where she lived, near her mother's exit. And Tony Chimel and I passed that accident at 3 o'clock, 3:30 in the morning. And we didn't even know it was Joey.
Wow.
There was the police cars there. And I remember Chimel going, Kyoto, look at this accident, you know, and I'm like, holy crap. It was fire trucks and everything, a ton of police cars and ambulance. And we couldn't see anything that was going on. And then we were just like, wow, we drove slow past it. And then we were home in another 10 minutes or so. And then we get a call at like 6:30 in the morning from Gorilla Monsoon telling me what happened. It was crazy.
Oh, my gosh.
And I had taken a shower. Like after the matches, Joey, we were in the locker room, we showered, got ready. And I was like, Joey, what are you doing? And he's like, well, he had just moved to Tampa, Florida. And he's like, I got to get home and I got to pay bills and I got to do this stuff. I haven't been home in 17 days. I'm like, why don't you like stay with your mom, stay with us. We're going to go down to Jersey Shore and hang out for the July 4th weekend, you know? It was right around July 4th. And I'll never forget that day. It's sad.
Yeah. Yeah. Good. Good guy. I remember this back in the day when you used to have to wear the blue shirts and the bow ties as referees.
Yes. Yes. I mean, you know, Joey taught me a lot coming into this business. He told me what to do, what not to do. And, you know, because he knew the old school talent better than I did coming in. I was green.
Mm-hmm.
He was teaching me. You know, he's the one who did Hulk Hogan and Andre the Giant match. He did.
Right.
I remember 1992 when I seen him do that match in Wembley Stadium in London. And it was the British Bulldog against Bret the Hitman Hart. And that match was like 45 minutes. And that crowd was unbelievable. It was just the horns. And there was 82,000 people there. I had worked that night with a tag match. But what really captivated me with that night was watching that match between Bret and Davey. And Joey was a referee in that. So, and that crowd was just going crazy. Crazy. I mean, it was like the horns were going. And it was like, Bulldog, you know.
It was one of the classics of all time.
Yeah, it was. It was. And that's what really wanted me. I was like, man, when Joe used to count the false finishes, I was like, that's what I, you know.
Yeah.
I get these crowds on their feet like that one day. But Joey taught me a lot, man. And, you know, I think, you know, I wish Joey would be in the Hall of Fame someday. But I don't know if a referee will ever make it to the Hall of Fame. you know? So we'll see.
Well, you would think it's one of those things, once again, such an important part of a great match is having a great referee. It's so important.
Yeah, and that's what, you know, and I appreciate, like, you see, of course, coming from you old school, Chris, you know, I'd love to hear that. You know, you always wanted to think you were important because, you know, there's three people in there that's got to tango together, or whether it's a tag match with five people. And I think a referee is definitely one of the most important things. And I think it's almost got away from that in the business now, in the industry a little bit with certain, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's always so spotty or so this, but I, you know, referees should be still one of the most important people in the ring to that match, in that match, whether it's giving cues or calling spots back and forth and just being there at the right time, you know, and doing what you're supposed to do. You know, you definitely don't go into business for yourself when you're a referee, that's for sure, you know.
Sure. That's, yeah. I mean, I guess this might not be the easiest question to answer, but do you like this style of wrestling better, where guys are calling more of it in the back and not feeling it? Did you feel back in those days when everything was basically called in the ring was more effective? Are they both effective? Is that just the evolution of the wrestling business? How do you feel about the style today compared to when you first broke in?
I mean, that's a very good question. I definitely like the old school way, because to me it's at times, like, it always feels like somebody has to go from A to Z.
Mm-hmm.
Like sometimes when you're running out of time, it seems like a lot of the talent doesn't, say if you had to go from A to F, they wouldn't cut out B and C and get right to the other point because they didn't know how to do that sometimes, you know?
Right.
So it was just like to where it's like, but if you called spots in the ring and you felt the crowd and you felt you're feeding off the people, you know, I thought it was more efficient, more successful back in the day with that, you know? And if the crowd, like, would shit on something, these guys today would go, okay, I still have to go to A, B, C, D, and E, and F, you know?
Right.
Or if we're running off the time at the air and we're like, I'm like, go home. I told you to go to hell home, you know? It would still seem like they would have to get their spots in. But, I mean, the talent these days is amazing, too. It's amazing in different ways, you know? Like, when I grew up with guys like you, Chris, and other talent from when I first started in this business, nobody had to get trained to anything, I thought. It was like, these guys just had, you guys just had talent. You had charisma. You know how to sell yourself. You know how to sell, period, in the ring. You know how to work a crowd. Everybody took pride in their characters, their gimmicks, their, you know, their outfits and their jackets. I mean, certain guys with jackets would be like, you know, like yourself, how many times you always have a different part of gear on, you know, and just like guys would have like all this cool gear. And I'd be like, damn, check this out. How much this jacket cost? Oh, $5,000. I'm like, what? $5,000. I'm like, but they took pride in their gear and stuff like that, you know, like more flamboyant back in the day, I thought.
Well, I mean, and that's the thing. It was much more of an emphasis on the show part of it than it is now. But once again, there's an evolution. It happens in hockey and it happens in,
yeah,
you know, comedy or whatever it may be. So last two questions for you. What kind of is your plan now? I mean, it's interesting because there's a layoff and there's a change, but we're in the middle of a world where you can't show up on a Saturday night at Ring of Honor or Impact or whatever to do anything because there's no shows right now because of the pandemic. But what do you have in mind as kind of your plan now that you have a whole new world in front of you?
Yeah, I mean, you know, like one door closes, Chris, the old saying, another one opens. So, you know, I'm ready to move on and stuff. And I got a lot more left in me, whether it's inside the ring too and outside the ring. And I'm going to move forward and hopefully these unbelievable times, I know, God bless for everybody going through this crisis and people have lost lives and everything. And, you know, and once we get through all this, I'm hoping to get back into the ring at some point and entertain the crowd again. So whether it's go international or do local stuff or, you know, and test the fields, I'm here, you know.
Which is great because, like I said, there's so much experience that you have that you can bring to the table for sure. So
yeah, I actually came out with my first T-shirt ever.
Yeah, it's coming out.
I'm like, you know, protees.com. So
ProWrestlingTees.com, right?
Yes, ProWrestlingTees.com. So I got some shirts coming.
Last question for you, man. What is, if it's not so easy, if there's a couple of them, what's the your favorite match that you ever refereed?
I would have to say, man, there's so many of them, Chris. You know, crowd-wise, you know, there was. I mean, it just, you're asking me for one match, the favorite one.
Well, just give me a few that stand out for you, sure.
It was like, be honest with you, Chris Benoit, Eddie Guerrero. Mm-hmm. I remember that was in Denver, Colorado. That was an unbelievable match. Rock and Hogan, the crowd-wise in Toronto. I mean, Toronto was, it was just a phenomenal crowd, the reaction. And, yeah, there's quite a few of them. I just don't want to say, you know, one of them.
Right.
But there was, you know, there was Shawn Michaels versus Stone Cold in Boston Garden. I remember Brock Lesnar and Big Show with the ring collapsing.
Oh, that's right. You were in there for that.
Yeah, that was phenomenal.
Yeah. Talk about that bump, because you never really got a chance to rehearse that. You just kind of had to go with it, right?
Yeah, I mean, Michael Hayes, everybody loved it, the way I sold that bump in the back, you know. So it was something, actually, I didn't know what to expect when the ring collapsed because you couldn't rehearse that, you know?
Right.
But the crowd just came off their feet and I just kind of looked around and was just like stunned. Like I'm thinking, holy crap, is this what a ring looks like when it does collapse? And two of the biggest dudes were over there selling, you know, Big Show and Brock, you know?
Yeah.
And I'm just sitting there like, and the crowd's just going nuts. Like, you know, the first time we ever pulled that stunt off. And that was awesome. That was an awesome feeling. So it was really what I didn't do as a referee was just basically how I sold my face, had, you know, the reaction of me like selling it, collapsing. So that was really, wasn't too hard to do. You know? But, you know, I mean, a lot of matches with Shane McMahon and Kurt Angle back in the day.
God, they used to kill each other.
Yeah. Oh, yeah. You know? And, you know, Shane had a lot to prove and Kurt was like, yeah, I got a lot to prove too. And you're going to earn this. You know?
Well, dude, it's great to get a chance to catch up with you and talk to you. And like I said, you should be very proud of 35 years in the WWE. That's something that will probably never be matched again. And like you said, you still got a lot more to do. So, yeah, man, like I said, much respect. Always one of my favorite referees and a great guy to hang with as well.
Man, I appreciate it, Chris, and it was an honor to be on your show, man. I really appreciate everything. Good talking to you, man. Hope to see you soon, all right?
Yeah, brother. Take care, man. Talk to you soon.
You too, Chris. Okay.
Bye.
Thank you.